You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although cancer is a very common diagnosis, most people know little more about it than it occurs when some of our cells start multiplying out of control. Joining us now to shed some light on it and to correct some misperceptions is Robin Hesketh, a professor in the Department of Biochemistry at the University of Cambridge for over 25 years. His book, Betrayed by Nature, is published by Palgrave Macmillan, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's a great pleasure to be here. And if I might say so, it's also a great joy to be back in New York again and to be reminded of just how kindly and friendly and courteous New Yorkers are.
Despite our reputation, I always wondered about that reputation.
Well, you know, that just warns you that stereotypes are amusing and interesting, but they're often misleading. I mean, the Brits are very often put forward as not doing sex, but you only have to look at the 60 million in the UK to tell you that there's something slightly wrong.
At least one time. Is the very word cancer misleading? Doesn't it apply to a broad group of various diseases?
Yes, it certainly does. And it's an important point to bear in mind because it really cuts to the heart of cancer. In my book, Betrayed by Nature, I try to make the point that, in essence, cancers are very simple diseases to understand. But they are very complex, hence the fact that we haven't solved the problem of cancer. And the reason why they're complex is because essentially each cancer is different at the molecular level, even if the pathologists lump them together in a particular classification.
Well, what they have in common is that they're kind of cells run wild. The medical term is malignant neoplasm. Neoplasm meaning a tumor?
No, not strictly speaking. Neoplasm simply means new growth. Mm-hmm. So we've all got neoplasms. You just have to look at any bit of most of our bodies and you'll find birthmarks and moles and things like that. Perfectly harmless. And those are neoplasms. They're slightly abnormal growths. But what happens in cancer is that the regulatory mechanisms that control normal cell growth actually go wrong as a consequence of mutations. And when that happens, what happens is that cells either proliferate, they divide more rapidly than they should, or they divide and multiply at a time when they shouldn't, or they divide and multiply somewhere they shouldn't.
But tumors also go through a similar kind of process. Why are they benign while cancers are malignant?
Okay, there are two answers to that question. The first is the really honest answer, and we don't know. But there are clear differences between benign tumours and malignant tumours. Benign tumours are usually what the medics like to call encapsulated. That means they have a kind of membrane around them. And the abnormalities that give rise to that growth, because clearly they are abnormal growths, they are neoplasms, are ones that don't normally go on to drive the tumour into being malignant. And so they're harmless unless they grow somewhere where they press on something or do something mechanical that's difficult.
Another term is precancerous. Now, can we spot something that's precancerous?
Well, we certainly can, and that really puts the finger on one of the most exciting areas in contemporary research. So we know that the development of cancers is a cumulative process. One of the reasons why cancers are so difficult to deal with is that they're genetic diseases, they're caused by mutations. But in contrast to the several thousand other genetic diseases, of which perhaps cystic fibrosis might be one of the best known, it isn't a single mutation in a single gene and a single protein that goes wrong. It's a group that you need to drive cancers. So that's one of the reasons why they're so complex.
And it's also started by different things. You can have viruses starting cancers. You can have cells that have been affected by the sun. You can have cells that have been affected by smoking.
Indeed, and that is another sort of major feature really to bear in mind about cancers. To some extent, cancers arise because of factors that we can't control. So there's radiation around us all the time, from the ground, from the air. We can't do anything about that. There are other factors that we can't control. But equally, there are factors that we can. So extreme exposure to sunlight, especially if you're fair-skinned, a major cause of melanoma, and, of course, most people will know about the influence of smoking and the fact that over 90% of lung cancers are caused by smoking. So that's something we do to ourselves.
But some people get cancer from smoking, others don't. Is that because of a genetic predisposition?
Almost for sure. So we all know stories of people who live to 100 and smoke like chimneys and don't get cancer, and they're lucky guys. They've got some kind of genetic background that just simply has not degenerated in terms of being corrupted by tobacco smoke, by the chemicals in tobacco smoke. But the vast majority of us don't have that. So we can be really confident that people who smoke almost certainly will get lung cancer at a relatively early age. But the point that I think you're getting at is again, this massive diversity, in this case of nature as a whole. Genetic diversity is what makes us all different from one another, and it means that some people are indeed resistant, as it were, to some types of cancer.
And then we hear about people who've had cancer operations, and that's the end of it for the rest of their lives. And then others, that nasty word metastasize comes
up. Yeah, that is the critical nasty word. It's worth bearing in mind, it's terribly easy in the cancer field to get into a sort of doom and gloom scenario. So a little bit of very positive news to start with. If you think about the effects of particularly drug therapy over the last, say, 50 years, coupled with advances in surgery and radiotherapy, and you take a couple of the major cancers like prostate cancer and breast cancer, in the USA now, the five-year survival rate for women diagnosed with breast cancer is over 90%. For prostate cancer, it's very nearly 100%. So that represents phenomenal achievements in science. Of course, there are other cancers, we already mentioned lung, where the prognosis is still really absolutely dreadful.
But is that because those cancers, let's say the prostate cancer, is less likely to metastasize than a lung cancer?
It probably means that for the most part, those conditions have been caught at a stage before they've metastasized. The real problem with cancers, the kind of critical tipping point in terms of treatment, is when the tumor metastasizes. So the vast majority of primary tumors can be treated very effectively by surgery. And that's the reason why there's so much emphasis in the cancer field about early diagnosis, early detection.
Still, it can metastasize pretty early because I knew someone who had a melanoma, and the first operation, the surgeons were very pleased. They said it had clean margins, and they sent her home happily. A few years later, there was another lymph node that where cancer started forming, and then after they cut those out with clean margins, it turned up somewhere else.
Absolutely. There's no surefire way of guaranteeing that you haven't already got a metastasis when you carry out primary surgery. That's really the bottom line.
So what happens there? A cell just wanders off through the bloodstream?
Yes, in essence, that's pretty well what does happen. You're highly likely to ask next what makes it do that. And we have some clues now about what the molecular changes are in cells that actually give them the capacity to metastasize. To be absolutely honest, until really the last 10 years or so, we've had no clue about that at all. But the extraordinary revolutions of the last 10 years technically mean that we're beginning to get a handle, just beginning to get a handle on what it is that makes a cell, as you put it, decide to wander off from a primary tumour, get into the circulation, drift round the circulation, find a secondary site, and then burrow through the wall of the vessels that have brought it there and set up home, as it were, in a new niche. It's worth bearing in mind, mind you.
But it has to find kindred cells, doesn't it?
Well, it has to find a new home. It's probably a better way of putting it. So it has to set up home in a novel environment for that tumour. And you could imagine that that's actually a pretty difficult sequence of events for a cell to manage. And actually, the overall efficiency of metastasis is terrible. It's very, very low. A fraction of a percent of cells actually make it to seed secondary growths. So fortunately for us, it's a very inefficient process. But when it does work, A, it's the cause of the vast majority of cancer deaths, because these metastatic sites are next to impossible to treat. And B, it's a consequence of a combination of really rather serendipitous events as far as the tumour cell is concerned. It's managed to burrow its way through the vasculature and get into a new niche. And then it finds a niche which, maybe not immediately, metastases, what are sometimes called in the trade micrometastases, we know can sit there for many, many years. It's very interesting data acquired a few years ago from road traffic accident victims, and it turned out that essentially every adult has detectable micrometastases if you cut out the tissue and look by a pathological stain. So they're almost certainly there, sitting there in me and you. The chances are
that they have to light up.
Something has to turn them on, and we have to keep our fingers crossed that that doesn't happen to us.
My guest is Robin Hesketh, the Department of Biochemistry at the University of Cambridge and a fellow at Selwyn College. His book is Betrayed by Nature, The War on Cancer. So you also appear on the BBC and are widely published, mostly in attempts to clear up some of the common misconceptions about cancer.
I think that's true. I don't, by saying I appear on the BBC, I don't wish to give the impression that I'm sort of doing game shows or whatever. But it is true that, of course, occasionally the media come to people that they feel in the field and know something about the issue. Unfortunately for us scientists, we're very often cast in a rather dubious light when this happens, because, of course, the questions people want to ask are the questions that we don't know the answers to. So one, for example, that I talked on the BBC about a few years ago is the long-running question of whether electromagnetic fields from overhead power lines can give rise to cancers, particularly childhood leukemias. And all that one can say about this is that there's no evidence that one would suggest, as a scientist, really is conclusive and stands up that such things do happen. But the problem is that you're being asked to adjudicate on a negative, and you can't really do that.
And isn't this a problem anyway when people try to go, when they sue a company for having put them into a situation that led to cancer? It's almost impossible to prove that having worked at that asbestos factory 35 years ago is the reason that you have cancer today.
Well, it depends on the specific example. As far as electromagnetic fields are concerned, exposure to them, I think it's impossible, because there's no real convincing epidemiology data, in my opinion at any rate, and there's no sort of experimental lab data. You mentioned asbestos. That's actually the one exception, because we know that the particularly unpleasant form of lung cancer called mesothelioma is almost always caused by the damage that asbestos fibres in the lung actually do to the lung. So that's one exception.
As a scientist, do you have to fight the misconceptions that people get from watching television shows? And not the ones you're on, of course.
Well, nor shows like yours, I think. But yes, there is a big problem, I think. I think, certainly in the UK, when Betrayed by Nature was getting towards publication, I actually started running a blog. And the reason for doing that was to try to explain a little bit more clearly some of the topical items that came up in the press. Now, I'm talking only about the UK press, not at all about the New York Times or anything like that. But science is often not well explained in the press or by the BBC.
Too busy hacking into people's cell phones.
Well, that may be true. But I think the real problem is that, of course, journalists need to get their stuff published, so there's a real pressure to have a catchy headline, and catchy headlines are usually inimical to quality science. So that's something I think we need to kind of To fight against is probably putting it a little bit strongly, but to, at least to be aware of and just try to counter. It's a responsibility of the scientists themselves to try and counter that for people who don't know any science or don't know much science at any rate.
My guest is Robin Hesketh, who's written a book called Betrayed by Nature, The War on Cancer. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we will look at some other reasons that cancers form and what treatments are being developed to take care of them. We'll try to cover as much territory as we can. We're back with Robin Hesketh of Cambridge University. He is in the Department of Biochemistry, and he has written a book called Betrayed by Nature, The War on Cancer, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And you're in Cambridge, where we first understood the structure of DNA. How important is understanding that structure of DNA and the relationship of it to RNA, the sorts of things that we now actually learn in the ninth grade biology classes? How important is that to understanding the how cancers develop?
It's absolutely crucial and fundamental. I mean, I think you could say without fear of exaggeration that when Francis Crick and James Watson elucidated, albeit with the help of others, the double helix structure of DNA that everybody's nowadays very familiar with, as you say. That was in 1953, and that started what you might call the molecular biology revolution, which has been gathering pace ever since. And it was crucial because it suggested how DNA might replicate, and it wasn't too long after that before we were able to scramble the DNA code, so we knew how it was that the sequence of bases in DNA were read by the cellular machinery, made, as you say, into RNA as an intermediate, and then into protein.
So is part of the process that the RNA sends brings misinformation to a cell?
It can be, but in the sense that changes can actually occur in RNA as well. It's a process called RNA editing, but
it's more likely in the DNA.
For the vast majority of cases, it's mutations in the DNA, it's damage, corruption to DNA, that then leads to the production of abnormal proteins and hence abnormal cell function in cancers.
So where do the proteins in our cells fit into this story?
Well,
you say abnormal proteins.
Yeah. Well, we are proteins. So we're 70% water, and most of the rest of us that you see is proteins. About 18-20% of us is protein. So proteins are what Max Perutz, who arguably could be described as the founder of molecular biology, described as the machines of life. They're the guys that do all the work. So they make metabolic reactions happen. It's proteins that break down our food when we eat it and convert it into a form that we can use as energy. And the proteins are the things that delineate one cell type from another, and they regulate cell proliferation, whether a cell is dividing or whether it isn't. And so you could imagine from that very easily how even one anomalous protein can give rise to a serious disease condition. Lots and lots of metabolic diseases, for example, where just one mutation in DNA gives rise to a misacting protein, and now you've got the disease.
You explore the topic of cell receptors at some length in this book. What do they do, and how do they change to contribute to the development of cancers?
Well, receptors on cells are exactly what their name implies. They're proteins that sit on the outer surface or across the outer surface of cells, and they're the way in which cells communicate with the outside world. So if you're trying to if you think of an organism as an aggregate of a huge number of cells, you need to regulate what each of the cells in that organism does to have a controlled and functional system. That's particularly true in the context of whether you want a cell to divide or not. So the cells in our body are a heterogeneous bunch. Some of our cells are dividing like bilio all the time. Some of them never divide again or scarcely ever divide again after we've developed, our brain cells, for example, unfortunately. And others only do it on
cue. They go in the other direction.
Yeah, no, well, I was going to say that. I can't speak for
you. That's based on experience.
but other cells are sitting there waiting to be cued. And the classic example of that, for example, is if you cut yourself and you know perfectly well that the bleeding stops, the cell damage is repaired, and after a while you can't tell that anything's happened. Now, the reason for that is that signals have interacted with receptors on the surface of cells and they've told them to start multiplying to repair the damage and fix it. And the problem with cancer is that if those signals become anomalous in any way, and that can be because the signal itself is anomalous or because the receptors get mutated. And a very common form of change in cancers is that mutations in receptors mean that the receptor is now deaf to the outside world. So now it doesn't need its molecular cue from the outside world. It just gets on and says, cell divide. And then you've got a recipe for the development of a neoplasm, as we were saying before, and perhaps then a malignant cancer.
There's a word that I'm a bit confused by, cell apoptosis.
Apoptosis, yeah. Apoptosis. People pronounce things however they will. Well, that's the other side of the coin. It's very important in cancer. What it means is that cells commit suicide, in essence. Now, that may seem intuitively a very strange thing for cells to do, but actually it turns out to be a critical part of our development. So I sometimes say to students when I'm lecturing that when I hold up my fingers and wave them around, I'm able to do that because the webbing that was originally between my fingers when I was in the embryo was actually destroyed by a process of what's sometimes called programmed cell death, but the more informative title. So the point about apoptosis is that it can kill cells. It turns out, and again relatively recently, that apoptosis is a critical balancing component of our way of protecting ourselves against cancer, because one of the first defense mechanisms of cells when they acquire mutations and start behaving peculiarly and start dividing when they shouldn't is they commit suicide. The body kills them. So a very good way of developing cancer is to have a mutational mechanism that blocks that capacity for suicide. And that seems to happen in most cancers, maybe even in all cancers. So it's a balancing act. On the one hand, you have abnormal forces driving proliferation. And on the other hand, you can have abnormal forces which are knocking out a cell suicide response.
Now, I've been told that one of the problems with stem cells right now is there's the possibility that because we're encouraging the cells to grow, we don't have any way to stop them from growing.
I think there's a certain degree of confusion here. I mean, stem cells are a very hot topic, and the reason for that is that there have been some astonishing advances in the last few years in taking stem cells, which are cells at a very, very early age of development, not long after fertilization, after the egg has been fertilized by the sperm, which have the capacity to develop into all the different types of cells of our body. And that's why they're so powerful, as potentially a way of repairing damage, growing new organs and whatever. They've come into the cancer field in a way that I think is a little bit misleading, because stem cells have the capacity to divide and to proliferate, they're often referred to as being immortal. There's a notion that cancers are a form of stem cell, and indeed they are, because they indeed can proliferate abnormally. But I think that I would say that the likeness to stem cells to some extent is coincidental. If you like, when cells have finally developed, the program of normal stem cell development becomes suppressed, switched off. And under some circumstances, clearly that can be switched on again in cancer cells. So you get what I prefer to call a sort of stem cell-like tumour cell. It's stem cell-like because it's proliferating when it actually, in this case, when it shouldn't.
My guest is Robin Hesketh, H-E-S-K-E-T-H. His book, Betrayed by Nature, The War on Cancer, published by Palgrave Macmillan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. An aspect of cancerous tumors is that they create their own blood vessels. Why is this a necessary development for the growth of a tumor?
Well, we believe it's a necessary growth requirement because For cells to grow, they really need two things. They need, they're really like the organism itself. They need food, they need nutrients of some sort, and they need oxygen. And for cells within the body, food and nutrients are delivered by the bloodstream. And so the rough rule is that cells need to be within something like about 10 cells diameter, about 100 microns, of a blood vessel, albeit perhaps a very small capillary, for it to have the appropriate supply of nutrients. Now, we mentioned a little while ago the notion that a lot of us may well have what are called dormant tumours, sort of sitting around in our body and not doing anything. And we don't really know what kickstarts those guys. But one of the likely explanations is that they've not found a way of turning on the host blood supply so that it actually makes new blood vessels. It's a process very often called sprouting, which is a very evocative term. Literally, the host blood vessels start to proliferate in response to a signal from the tumour. They throw out, as it were, new shoots, and they kind of make a little branching tree that goes into the tumour, nourishes and feeds the tumour. Now you've got a process that's known as angiogenesis, and now if that's a dormant tumour, you're in trouble.
Listeners have been writing in. One listener asks about oncogenes. What are they? And if you don't have them, do you have a lower risk of developing cancer?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question because it goes back to the point we were discussing earlier about misrepresentation in press reports about cancer-related matters. So the point about oncogenes is that it's a term that means a gene that has undergone some kind of mutation. So what we have in our DNA is a whole load of genes in humans, somewhere in the region of about 20, 22,000 different genes. And those genes, if you like, the ones that encode proteins, you could describe as proto-oncogenes. That's the term that's often used. And what proto-oncogenes means is that to make an oncogene, this perfectly normal gene, which has a perfectly normal function, which is essential for the development and the well-being of our bodies, needs to undergo a mutation. So an oncogene is a perfectly normal gene that's been corrupted in some way and now has the potential to contribute to the growth of a cancer.
Now, another listener wonders, okay, it's one thing for the cell to proliferate and it can grow and become a big lump, but why does it kill us?
Well, we touched on the notion of benign tumours a little while before, which indeed it can be big lumps and don't kill us, and we don't bother about those unless they do something odd like press on a nerve or something like that. The issue of how cancer kills us is a very interesting question because I mentioned that if primary tumours can be caught early enough and removed by surgery, very often that's extraordinarily effective at protecting us against cancer. But the question questioner I think is really asking, okay, what happens if that doesn't work? What happens if cancers get a hold and they end up killing us? How do they do it? For the most part, it's a slightly surprising answer. For the most part, it's through infection. I mean, there are some exceptions to this. There are tumours that can affect the viscosity of the blood. For example, some of the leukemias do this. And of course, that you can perceive how that might kill us. But for the most part, what happens is that side effects of the growth of the tumour, in particular suppression of the immune system, can leave us very vulnerable to infection. And so vulnerable, in fact, that although we have antibiotics that can treat quite a number of common infections, we're so vulnerable that we keep on being infected and we can be susceptible, of course, to viral infections that are much more difficult to treat. So in a lot of cases, the thing that actually kills people in the end actually is infection.
Now, the two most common treatments for cancer are radiation and chemotherapy, and they don't always work, and they definitely don't always work with every kind of cancer. Other approaches in the works?
Well, there certainly are. As I said, if primary tumours can be caught early enough, then the combination of surgery, very often with radiotherapy and a kind of adjuvant, as it's called, additional protective chemotherapy, works really very, very well indeed. But the real problem, as we've mentioned, is if tumours have already spread elsewhere in the body. And the question is, at the moment, those are all incredibly difficult to detect. very difficult to
treat. Can you spot them under a microscope?
Well, you could spot them if you took the tissue in question and sliced it and stained it the way the pathologists do. That's how the data from the traffic accident people was obtained. But, of course, you can't do that as a normal screening
procedure. Well, you could do it with melanoma because it's a dark cell. But
melanoma is the one exception, of course, because they sit on the surface of the skin. But what I think is really, really exciting, and it's another byproduct of the revolution in DNA sequencing, is that there is a huge effort going on at the moment to detect what are called tumour biomarkers. And that really means things that are wandering around in the blood circulation that might give us the very, very earliest indication that there's a tumour somewhere. And these might be metabolites, small molecules made by the tumour, or it might actually be, again, to use your expression, the odd tumour cell that's broken off and wandering around. And we now have methods that can are beginning to be able to detect very, very small numbers of such cells. And it may be that that's going to open a whole new field in terms of early cancer detection.
One of the ways of detecting cancer is to use PET scans and CAT scans. Mm-hmm. But I've read recently that they might actually exacerbate the problem.
Well, that's the problem with at the moment with the whole imaging field. Mammography, PET scans, CT scans, whatever. They're great and they have a very valuable role to play. But they're really rather crude instruments. They can't detect very small tumour growths, very small metastases, and that's the real big problem. And that's why there's so much excitement about the notion that we might just be able to pull out very small numbers of cells in a routine blood test. 5 mils of blood will do fine for this. It's no big deal. And that we might then be able to pull out very small numbers of cells to give us perhaps the earliest possible indication of a tumour growth being present.
I don't know what this says about what our listeners do in their spare time, but a number have listed on our show page questions about whether smoking marijuana can cause cancer in the same way that smoking cigarettes can.
To be absolutely honest, I don't actually know of a study that links marijuana smoke to cancer per se.
Because people often smoke marijuana when they're undergoing chemotherapy. It actually seems to have a positive effect.
That's a sort of swings and roundabouts in extremist kind of argument, I guess, and I think that's just fine. I mean, if you're asking my advice, it would be don't smoke. If you do smoke, give up.
Just one more thing. We're focusing on Western medicine. Are there approaches that we should be looking for in China, for example, which has a very long history of medicine?
It certainly does. And not merely are those approaches being looked for, but of course they've actually been very productive. I mean, quite a lot of the drugs that we use have come from traditional therapeutic methods, traditional medicines of one sort or another, where the active chemical ingredient has actually been isolated, and we now use that as a drug. And there are drug companies that have made a lot of dosh doing exactly that sort of work. So I think that there is still scope for particularly for looking at herbal remedies and asking, is there anything in this? And can we get the real chemical ingredient that's crucial out? Can we extract it and then use it?
Robin Hesketh is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry at the University of Cambridge. He has also written for Nature, American Journal of Pathology, Biochemical Journal, Biochemistry, The Lancet, Oncology, among other publications. And his book is Betrayed by Nature, The War on Cancer, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a great privilege and a pleasure.